Hello, TCO listeners. I am here today with John and Lori Mathias, hosts of Hidden, a true crime podcast. The Hidden True Crime podcast explores the hidden motives behind unimaginable crimes. Dr. John is a forensic psychologist and Lauren is a longtime journalist. This married couple has dived into the psychology and the avenues of the Vallow and Daybell cases while examining why serial predators do what they do. John, Lauren, thank you so much for joining me today on The Chosen Ones, and I'm so excited about our collaboration.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So listeners, some fans of our podcast, as well as Hiddens, have stated that we pair really well together, like a fine wine with a five-course meal, what they're doing and what we're doing. Pretty different, but we are kind of examining all the same things, but you guys have really delved into some psychoses and talking about that stuff, which I love. So I'm so excited to talk about this. So let's just jump in then. So when did you guys first hear of this case and what inspired you to look into it?
I think it was December, right? Early December. It was right when the Woodcocks wrote their Facebook post saying, we've got to find these kids. This is happening and this is happening. The journalist in me, I'm the one that's on Facebook in this relationship, and the journalist in me just, my heart just, whoa. And I ran on and gave him the play-by-play. This is happening. This is going on. John and I have always talked about crime together. In fact, the first phone call we had after we were set up, we talked for 3 hours and crime was mentioned. You know, the case I was working on, his thoughts, he assesses criminals.
So
the moment this, the moment we heard about this in December, which is crazy to think, it's almost coming up on a year.
Exactly. Right.
We did not stop talking about it. So you're right. We have been talking about this case for 10 months, 11 months now, nonstop.
And it, it seemed like as we learned more and more information every day, it became more and more bizarre. So of course that just tweaked. That picked our interest even more. So, of course, like most people, we developed a fascination with this case because things just kept evolving daily, right? And things kept getting bizarre, and there were more and more things coming out every day.
Players, which is what you cover so well, all the different players.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
We've got to keep track of them all.
Yeah.
It's hard. That's great. We can lead into telling us a little bit about your podcast and what you guys have examined thus far and whatnot.
A lot. One thing, so you cover the players, and we love that about your podcast.
We cover
something that no one else seems to be covering, which are the whys. Our podcast is called Hidden because it's not just the motives, right? The motives in are usually always the same: sex and money and what else?
Revenge.
Yep.
Hidden motives, meaning let's dig deeper.
Yeah. So, I mean, a big part of my job as a forensic psychologist is to go below the surface to do some testing. One of my favorite assessment instruments is the Rorschach, which is all about digging below the surface and looking at the unconscious. It's not a super popular instrument these days, by the way, but when I was in grad school, it was still considered a valid popular instrument. And grad school, you know, when I was in grad school in the 90s, I was a little skeptical even then about the Rorschach because there was some criticism, but the more I've used it, the more I've become a true believer. It's an amazing tool for really bypassing those conscious processes and digging deeper. And I think we actually thought about using like an ink blot as part of our logo.
That
idea of finding what's hidden. So we're all about trying to find those deeper motivations that are driving behaviors. You know, you might say, well, this is being driven by greed, right? But the question is, but why do they want the money, right? That's a motive that's self-explanatory, but that's not the real motive, right? What is the money doing for this person? Is it giving them status? Is it giving them power, security? Like, what are those psychological needs that lay behind those surface motives? And that's kind of what we're up to.
And I think that's one reason why some are fascinated with the case is because, right, I shouldn't speak for others, for me, growing up Mormon and used to being Mormon and what looks like a seemingly nice Mormon mom from photographs and this Mormon author, I have to be honest, I think I really was drawn to the case was, I started my career in Rexburg, Idaho. Relatives live there. So I think that it was just so close to home for me. And I think those hidden motives were really, really important for me to understand. I didn't know how to answer the hidden motives, right? My husband does. So I think that's where the conversation starts too, is I think I had a really deep personal need to really understand the whys in this case, because it just blew my mind. And so my husband, John, is always, we're always so willing to talk about these things at dinner and beyond. And so I think, I think that that's one reason in this case, the hidden motives were so important to us too, is because I think I really needed to know what was below the surface.
Well, needless to say, you guys are couple goals. Like, I would love to find someone who I can have these conversations with, because that's amazing. So, and you're right. And that's why your podcast is so crucial for people to listen to, because those are the things that we may or may not see in trial, because that's, we see everything on, the outside, on what the media is covering, but you guys are really diving into the psychoses of these things. And it's really important, because we've heard a lot of different rumors or speculations about why they're doing it. Just as you said, John, the motive there is money, but you go that extreme for that amount of money, it just doesn't seem.
And why, right? And why? Yeah,
exactly. Right.
It's never in every crime I've ever assessed. It's easy to say, if you watch Dateline, for example, they're going to argue that every crime is either greed, lust, or revenge. But in my world, it's never those things. It's always something. Yeah. So
right.
My job is to find those deeper things so that something can be done about it. Or, assuming that the victim is still alive, which...
some are and some aren't in this case.
Right. Well,
exactly.
But like with sex offenders, 90% of sex offenders, they harm their victims, of course, but they don't kill them. So there are sex offenders that rape and murder, but that's a small subset. So especially with sex offenses, the question is, can the person be rehabilitated? And if so, what are those deeper issues that we need to look at to do that?
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's a great question. So great segue again. So you initially researched Chad's psyche and how detached he was in social and emotional settings. So what was like the highlight that you guys found, or something that struck you, that way?
I think one of the initial observations I had about Chad was, this is based on his autobiography, but was the fact that he mentioned his mother 3 times in passing in his book. So he has this 200-page autobiography, and he barely even, he barely even mentions his mother. He barely mentions his siblings. He barely mentions, it's clear if you read this book that relationships are secondary to him.
Right.
His book is essentially promoting himself as a prophet. So it's a really self-absorbed document about how you see, just from that alone, you can gather a lot of useful information, and you can say, without even really knowing his history, I can say, well, this is someone who obviously doesn't stress relationships, and he's not comfortable in relationships. And it was speculation, it probably still is, but he was probably insecurely attached as a child. And, those attachment bonds are so critical in our later development. Like, that's one of the research findings in forensic psychology these days is that attachment relationship has strong predictive value about someone's ability to be pro-social and to develop relationships that are going to lead to success later in life. And as I kind of say in the podcast, if we're not attached, then we're detached.
Yeah.
And if we're detached, then we're, in some ways, we're more antisocial because we're not a part of that community that keeps us grounded.
Mm-hmm.
So with Chad, you see that. You see some detachment and you see this general discomfort with relationships, I think. And we've learned a lot more about that.
Yes,
since we've since that first
the start of that.
I'm sure you know, like us, Celine, that when you start this podcast, you're starting it with good information, but as you go and people listen, more and more people reach out. More and more people, you know, start talking to you. And so we started out with a lot of information, but as we have 11 episodes total now in a True Crime podcast, but as we did it, we started hearing from people close to the case, more sources, and learned a lot more, which I think we can say that helped us know we were, they've always let us know we were on the right track from the beginning.
Yeah.
Allowed us to have more information too.
Mm-hmm. And I think I can say with more certainty that those initial observations have been confirmed that he does seem to have a very distant relationship with his mother. The family keeps things on the surface. There's this emotional disengagement in the family. But all the things that you might see from someone who's insecurely attached.
Right. And that's interesting because, especially when we look at prolific serial killers that we all know, you know, I've been researching and working with the Ted Bundy case specifically on the cold cases, but having to look into him. Mm-hmm. And that's a similar pathway that he had, you know, that horrible relationship with his mother, you know, again, siblings, like it just wasn't there. But that is a really decent correlation and finding of that, because I don't think people, again, know this information about him, about Chad. And so when we look at his attraction to someone like Lori, it makes sense, you know, of that. So you also referenced his closed-mindedness along with his acceptance of paranormal phenomenon. Mm-hmm. How do you think that contributes to his cult-like behavior?
I think it's critical in explaining the cult-like behavior because there's a, in personality theory, there's something called the five-factor model. So five major personality traits that have been studied and validated. And by now there's been thousands of studies confirming this stuff. And people tend not to be satisfied with it because in some ways it's so simplistic. But so people have challenged this model over and over again, but the research just keeps confirming it. And one of those factors is called openness to experience. And openness to experience is really important in explaining someone's ability to take in new information and to stay open to the world and to learn and to grow and experience new things. You know, typically people high in this category will be more artistic. They'll be more creative. The important point is that, if you read Chad's autobiography, there's very little self-reflection. There's very little analytical thinking. There's just this general acceptance that his beliefs are true. And so that would be typical of someone who's very low on openness to experience. So I think if you looked at the five-factor model and looked at the various traits, that if I were trying to predict how Chad Daybo would fall on some of these traits, I would say that would be one of the most important ones.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
There's also a correlation between what's called need for closure, which is a similar trait. It's just we're using a little bit of different language, but there's a strong correlation between need for closure and terrorism. So terrorists have been shown to have a very similar type quality. So this, to get back to your question about this cult-like behavior, This trait or this variable, openness to experience, goes a long way in terms of explaining that. So he's very closed to new experiences. He comes from a religious family. He accepts it wholesale. In fact, he digs in deeper into this, you know, into his religious beliefs and augments it, his own version of things. And so I think it's easy to see someone who's really closed-minded getting caught up in the wrong way, belief system, and going further like Chad did with his ideas and his fantasies, essentially.
You can say that again. Right. Yeah.
Portals.
And I think do you guys have my notes? Because that's where I'm going.
Yeah. So. That was a favorite part of the Julie Rowe.
Well, and I was just going to touch on that.
Portals within portals.
Yes, because I had to go through a lot of portals in that seminar. But it's interesting you say that because, again, we look at those people around them who also have the same kind of ideology and behaviors, just like Julie Rowe. I mean, and you mentioned the terrorist factor. And I talked about this with Lauren on the live and then also with April about the conspiracy video that they showed with Back to the Future and correlating that to 9/11, but really honing in on the terrorist aspect of it. So it's just, it's interesting because there is that behind it.
There's a high correlation, you know, the difference. We talk about this in one of our episodes, but... You know, the purpose of a terrorist organization is to spread fear and spread terror, whereas the purpose of a cult is not necessarily to do that. Although many cults do that, that's right. Not necessarily their purpose. Their purpose is to perpetuate their belief system. And I mean, obviously there's a huge range of cults, but so there are slight differences between terrorist organizations and cults.
Right. But there's still that weird...
Yeah.
Little niche of it. So I know you guys also touched on their murderous schemes. So what do you think is the biggest contributing factor was for Lori and Chad? that's coming up. Loaded question.
Kind of. It's on its way.
How much time do we have?
Oh, I have all night. Yeah, but if you could sum it up.
We've got 11 episodes on this, but yeah. We're about to kind of...
Yeah.
You know, it's a different...
How about one of the things that you've touched on prior, so listeners have to go and listen to these new episodes?
I think it's a different answer for each of them, and here's a little teaser. The last episode of the season for us is going to get into that in depth. And I'm going to talk a lot about, I know this is going to sound odd, but
no.
I'm going to talk about Shakespeare's Macbeth. And I think Macbeth is, although that might sound strange at first, Macbeth to me is like almost, not a perfect, but a very good summation of what's going on here. So Macbeth, he's summoned by the witches, or the witches contact him at the beginning of the play, three witches. So that's the paranormal element, right? And they tell Macbeth, you're going to be king. And that's something that wasn't really on his radar. And so he starts believing that. He starts accepting that to be true, that he's going to be king. Yeah. And so he brings that back to his wife, Lady Macbeth. And he's not fully committed to that idea because he doesn't know how this can happen. But she tells him essentially, the witches are right. You know, when Macbeth starts doubting that vision, she reinforces it and says, they're right. She says, essentially, you need to man up and stop being such a wimp. And go do this. You need to kill the king so that you can become king. In other words, show me that what the witches said is accurate and go do something, go kill some people. So you can make it happen, right? And so I think there's a similar dynamic going on with Chad and Lori that I feel like Chad had these visions, but I don't know that he was fully committed to them. I mean, I think he believed them, but I think in some ways they were kind of in the fantasy realm. And then when he meets Lori, she becomes like Lady Macbeth. She pushes him to bring these to fruition. She pushes him to make them real. Because I think one thing we see about Lori is that she's very action-oriented. And Chad is a little more passive. And so I think Lori wanted to see some results, right? And so...
Oof, that gave me chills.
Yeah, I know, right? Right. Like, she wasn't content sitting around waiting for the sun to burn out and for that to be the apocalypse. She wanted billions of years. She was wanting to get to the New Jerusalem soon, right? I mean, they thought it was going to be in July. So obviously they were wrong. But so I think that dynamic is in play. But I think, you know, people ask us all the time, who's the leader? Who's behind this? And in Macbeth, if there's no witches, if there's no paranormal element telling Macbeth you're going to be king, then none of the murders happen, right? But then if there's no Lady Macbeth pushing him to take action and to fulfill the witch's vision through action, through murder, then there's no murders either. So I think it starts with the paranormal, but it's concluded with the behavior of his wife, or with the urging, the promptings of his wife. And so I think you probably see it. It's, I believe it's a similar dynamic. Lawrence is laying low here.
I'm laying low. No, I'm thinking, oh, you're telling her a lot.
Hey, but, it's, yeah.
Right. And I will say this, though, you know, John and I always stand by this, that we do agree that if it wasn't this toxic pair, toxic to say the least, I don't mean to undermine what they did. If it wasn't for this toxic pair, this tragedy wouldn't have happened. I think it was the combination. But we do believe that, and we have stated this again and again from the beginning, even before we started our podcast, the reason we started is because John came out and said this, online, and people wanted to know more, and then all of a sudden our podcast began. But very much so, we strongly believe that Chad is the one that wanted the kids killed. He is the oracle. He is the one who said, kill the kids. He is.
In our podcast coming up, we actually, and we talk about Julie Rowe's influence too a little bit, which we were actually talking about
before. We recorded it before her
seminar. We recorded it before the seminar, I'm happy to say. So, I said the week before that I thought Julie Rowe's influence on this case was much greater than people were aware of. And,
she has a 7-hour seminar, and we're like,
yep.
Yeah.
But my point, and to speak to Lauren's point about the analogy with Shakespeare, with Macbeth, is the books. The Chad's fiction, and his visions are in the books. And that's what gives him authority. So that's the near-death experiences and the books, which are his supposed fictional accounts. He says repeatedly that they're not fiction, but
exactly
by putting them in writing, it becomes a type of scripture.
Yep.
So the combination of this near-death experience, these two near-death experiences, and his books are what give him the authority to say that this New Jerusalem is real and that it's going to happen, and visions are real. And so that's the impetus behind everything. If there's no book, I think I said in our podcast coming up that the first sentence of the first book that Chad Daybell wrote was going to start a cascade of events that would turn out to be unstoppable, unfortunately. But that first book where he sat down and wrote that first sentence is a moment that all of us wish we could, we could erase, I think.
Yep. But I think you're onto something. And at this point, no matter how outlandish, you know, you may be making those correlations with Macbeth, but look at the correlations that they have been making with all this other fantasy stuff, including Julie Rowe and Wonder Woman and the Avengers and all these different components. But at the same time, that's the best way maybe for us, you know, to really look at that is through the lens of that, because they do look at these things and it seems like they are influenced by Harry Potter, by, you know, all of these weird things that we see. But again, they're taking that as doctrine. And just as you said, with that,
with Shakespeare, it's clearly fiction. Since we heard about this case in December and January, I've been telling Lauren, you know, this is just between us, but I'll say, you know, this reminds me of Macbeth so much. And the reason that's important is because this story has been told.
Yeah.
Everybody says, I can't understand this. This is something that's beyond comprehension. This is something I've never seen. No. It is to some degree. The specifics are, of course, but the general story about a person murdering, and people don't know this about Macbeth. Macbeth killed kids. Macbeth murdered kids. He like cleaned out anybody. He murdered anybody who could get in his way. Mm. And so there's that parallel too. But the story was told hundreds of years ago, right? And so that story of murder and power and greed, and it's been told before. And so I think that's why I think it's important that, you know, I'm gonna talk about this in our last podcast. It's gonna be, I'm gonna put everyone on really high nerd alert for that podcast.
I can't wait. Yes, no, I love it. Yeah, so listeners, please be sure to tune in on that, because now I can't wait for what you guys dive in there. So now that we've touched a little bit on Julie, so you have an episode about portals. And in Julie's seminar this past week, she kept referencing portals, but she would not elaborate more on them. So I'm curious to know your understanding of what that is.
Yeah, I think
that's why they fascinate us, right? Is what is...
You know, it's one of those quirky parts of this case that's probably my favorite part of the case, because it's so crazy, right? Like, you know, most people, when they talk about porters, they know it's fiction. Like, you see it in Alice in Wonderland.
Right. Well, I think one thing is, and you already brought it up, they seem to have no original ideas. Chad and Lauren Chad got everything from, and Julie, from a movie somewhere. That's definitely a theme. There are no original ideas in Chad Deva. So if you understand that, that helps us understand what a portal might be. Think Marvel movies. Secondly, he made portals in one of his fictional books. He mentions it multiple times, but in this fictional book, they used a portal to be able to get to a white and pristine and clean world, and rode the portal. And I don't have the book in front of me, so I can't say these were Chad's exact words, but he did use the words Marvel movie. And the character in the book said, wow, something about this portal. So now I'm not quoting, but the journalist, I need to say when I'm quoting, I'm not quoting Zen. Somehow it was the character saying, the dialogue between the characters is, oh my gosh, this is just like a Marvel movie. And the person responding to that character said, yeah, Hollywood got it right. I think that sadly, almost, it's almost like a punch in the gut because you want portals to be something a little bit more exciting. But sadly, I think we all know what they are, that he got them from a Hollywood movie. And go ahead. Yeah.
But I mean, I think your question, though, is what's the deeper psychological element? What's the construct? And the answer is, if you can bend space and time, you have a lot of power, right? Mm-hmm. You have deity-like powers. If you can go through a portal and transport yourself through space and through time to another dimension, you are godlike, right? And that's what they're looking for. You know, to answer your question earlier about what are the main psychological components driving Chad and Lori? For Chad, and I'm going to say that, do I say this in the upcoming podcast? Yeah, I do. We have.
I'm the editor, so I listen to everything. That's what he's asking.
The main psychological need that Chad's trying to fulfill is power. But I talk about it in terms of immortality. He wants immortality.
Yeah. Yeah.
He wants, and the Greeks called it kleos. That's spelled Kleos. Kleos. It's what Achilles and Odysseus and every Greek hero wanted. They want immortality. They want to be remembered and adored forever. And that's what Chad wants.
Yeah.
That's the underlying element that he's seeking.
Right. And
and so a portal is a means to that end, right?
Like
killing people, going through portals, leading the post-apocalyptic world for eternity. That's all about that need to be powerful and important and immortal, really, at some level. I mean, I think that's what he's seeking.
Yeah. And you're touching on great things that April Raymond also touched on in our Julie Rowe seminar overview, that she mentioned during 4th of July one year, Lori said that she didn't use a portal to get to Hawaii because she brought Tylee, and she couldn't use her portal power because Tylee couldn't do it, or she couldn't do it at the time. So that's an interesting factor. And then you also touch on the fact that she believed she was aging backwards, kind of like in Twilight. So again, this weird, just taking these films and applying them to their life. I mean, it's just, we'll get to that in a minute, but you're touching on very crucial points. So I just wanted to point that out. But speaking of Lori, why do we think she hates Oprah?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's why I think that went off in my head. But so why do you think Lori has such a strong hatred for Oprah? Have you been able to unpack that? Because that's a question I get asked all the time, and I have not even started with that.
Something we'd love to ask April a little bit more about, but go
ahead. Yeah. You know, since we talked about that a little in that podcast. Yeah. You know, my short answer to that was that I think Oprah's a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Dad and Lori, she's a threat to their belief system. She's a threat to the, you know, Oprah would be what I would consider like a secular saint, whereas they consider themselves to be more religious based. So I think Oprah threatens them on so many levels. I mean,
they're her worldview. Her world. What he means by that is they have different worldviews, right? Threat, and people liked her, and people listened to her.
Right.
Oprah's trying to improve ourselves, whereas Chad and Lori are interested in getting to the New Jerusalem. They're not as interested in self improvement. In fact, they're not interested in self improvement at all, right? Because they don't see that as being an important element to move on. They base their ability to move to the next level on their religious devotion and their purity and their morality, right? Whereas Oprah looks at that. Oprah's more interested in creating our best selves.
Yeah, right?
To put it, you know, more simply, because that's what I do. I'll just, I take what he says and break it down. I think it's, again, going back to the worldview, they're just, they're really different. Oprah is Black and they are white. Oprah is liberal and they are conservative. Oprah, and that is a threat because Oprah is well-loved and listened to, including among and Mormon women, right? Oprah is admired. Oprah is rich. Oprah is wealthy. There's
powerful.
She's powerful. She has
people. Right.
I mean, in some ways, Chad wanted to be Oprah.
Right.
You know, so.
Right.
She's loved. You know, she's everything they're not.
Right. She's everything they're not. And there's envy and there's anger. And that equals hate.
And there's probably, I mean, we haven't talked about this. We're trying to stay away from this because, but.
But hey, we'll just say it to Celine. Go ahead. What?
I mean, I'm sure there's some racial issues going on too.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A little white.
Which is.
Sure.
Well, and it's evident to see, again, sitting in that seminar, you know, I told Carl Danger, like, I'm probably one of the only women of color in this room right now, because everyone here is of, you know, white descent or, you know, Caucasian. Right. I think I only saw maybe two other people that could be of color, but that is another implication that I don't think many people have talked about yet because we're not positive, but judging by what she said in her class and me going back to the recordings, she said a lot about race and she kept saying the word race. So I don't think you're wrong there. Truly.
Well, you and I talking, I thought it was really interesting, Celine, when you were telling me about the event on YouTube. There was one point, and John wasn't on this call, so there was one point where you mentioned that she was talking about DNA being
altered.
Or altered. And then it sounds like, yeah, there's definitely some race, racism there. And then there was appropriation. We know that you talked about that. And yeah, there were some, definitely some interesting things, but that DNA transferring or altering was a very strange to me in the way, I don't know, maybe you can even tell John a little bit about it, but I remember saying to you on the call, sounds, and you were like, race.
Just, and going back and listening to the audio again right now, she's really honing in on that. So basically the conversation really came about, actually, let me just pull up my notes right over here. It kind of started with the COVID vaccine. That's where she kind of started spiraling a little bit of that, because she was saying that if you, any vaccine that you get, you are basically giving yourself to the dark spirit and they can alter your DNA at that point. And then you are automatically on the dark side of things at that point. But going back into it, she really started diving into premortal, prenatal, pregenerational, natal, preconception, conception, and inherited. So she's relating this to our DNA strands and six-stranded DNAs. She also started breaking down the, like, three-stranded DNAs and throwing out all these different numbers. But again, I don't know how I'm supposed to follow along because I don't know what the hell she's talking about, to be flat out honest, but I'm hearing, you know, the implications of race in this, but also light and dark spirits. But then sometimes it's like, yes, I think I know what light and dark spirits are, but at the same time, I don't know if that is an, you know, roundabout way of saying something racially. I don't know, to be flat out honest, but again, cultural appropriation was very evident in this seminar, and her saying that she can communicate with different spirits in different languages, and she has been different nationalities or ethnicities in other lives and other robes meaning bodies. So again, I don't think you guys are totally off the cuff on this. Like, you're on to something with that.
There's there's a common theme among a lot of cults that has to do with racial purification. And it seems like this cult fits that stereotype pretty well, or that profile pretty well.
They could call it people are good or evil. There's something light and dark.
I don't think it's necessarily conscious. I think it's opposite. But in other words, I don't think they're, or at least they're not openly saying that they want racial purification.
Right, exactly.
But it's certainly implied.
Even the quote that she posted, that she made a little meme of, you know, like this male and female, the creation of them. Like it just, again, it's all these underlining messages that I feel, to be honest, is what was happening. But again, as a woman of color sitting in this room of 200 people, it felt like the walls were closing in. Let's just, put it that way.
I'm sure it wasn't comfortable.
Yeah. So it was quite an experience, but that's for another day. Or listeners, please go listen to the Hidden podcast live that I jumped on with Lauren, and we talked more about this too. So if you can stand more Julie Rowe conversation, go do that. I want to pivot a little bit. So serial killer signatures and typologies. As I mentioned, working on the Ted Bundy case, so I'm very familiar with that in his side of things. But I thought it was interesting that you brought that up in the podcast, because I haven't considered that for Lori and Chad. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so I talked about how I believe that they fit the category of mission-driven serial killers in the sense that they were driven by this vision of the post-apocalyptic world. And most of the actions they were taken were driven by these visions rather than any, say, sadistic need to kill someone. So if you're talking about somebody like Bundy, and I don't, oddly enough, I don't know that case that well. So,
when COVID's over, we will have brunch, full day.
Bundy's been one of those serial killers that I don't know why, like Dahmer interests me a lot more than Bundy.
Tell you what, you didn't grow up in Utah.
This is true. That's the correlation, is the Utah connection, because I lived in the avenues, and where his old house was directly down the street of where I lived. So I wasn't too much into that, but that was the inspiration. Lauren got it.
Friend's father was his bishop, and there was the whole Mormon connection.
Oh, I know his bishop.
That's why he grew up near Chicago. He never even came out west until grad.
Oh, well, that's why the Dahmer. Maybe Gacy, too.
The Dahmer. Dahmer is, I don't know. Dahmer's bizarre at so many levels, like the cannibalism. And I mean, I could go on and on, but he's truly bizarre. Even among serial killers, like the level of pathology with him is unimaginable.
right. True.
But Bundy, not knowing Bundy well enough, but so I think Bundy would probably be more of a hedonistic type serial killer. But in the sense that they do it for like lust or pleasure, but he might fit the category of power too. I don't know. You probably know.
It's a mixed bowl, but yeah.
When Bundy was killing people, was he sadistic? Did he like get pleasure out of the actual killing?
Eventually. It was a level of escalation though. And that's a conversation that, is often argued, because people do often believe that he just woke up one day and decided murdering, which we know that's not the case. It's this level of sexual serial predation that starts, which it started with voyeurism, then it moved up to rape, which is very controversial when we're talking about Bundy. But I have found elements of that there's actual survivors that did report him raping prior to him murdering. So So if we're looking at that again, it's this escalation. Yeah. Yes, there may have been some sadistic elements to it, but it really was just the gratification of, I want more, I want more, I want more. That's really how I kind of see the psychology of him, at least. So
yeah, so I think the difference with Chad and Lori is that they were driven more by this broad vision or this broad mission,
yeah,
of the New Jerusalem that they had created, this fiction they created that they wanted to fulfill no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I know you guys also started digging into Lori's upbringing, which is something that I started to touch on a little bit with Trisha from Web Sleuths in her episode, but it is so upsetting. But in a brief summary, what do you think are some of the highlights from that that may have been a contributing factor, kind of like what you touched on with Chad?
Go for it.
I mean, the most salient issue would be abuse.
Yeah.
We know, we're pretty confident in saying there was definitely physical abuse, and we're reasonably confident in saying that there was probably sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm gonna qualify that and say we don't have definitive proof. There's never been any charges or allegations filed with Child Protective Services or through the police, or so. I mean,
sure.
No formal record of any abuse that we're aware of. But we have some pretty reliable sources that have confirmed that there's probably a lot of abuse, and it was probably chronic, meaning it went on for a year. And so that combination of abuse, especially if it's sexual, and chronic, lasting a long period of time or having a fairly long duration, is really bad for people's mental health.
Sure, right.
There's a high correlation between those two elements and borderline personality disorder, which
mm-hmm.
kind of talk about in a few of our podcasts.
Right.
And also, she doesn't borderline.
Yeah, no.
And I say that because I saw some arguments online today about someone saying she's this, no, she's this, no, she's this, no, she's this. So let's say this, you can be diagnosed with more than one.
More than one thing.
I actually quote the DSM, which is on page 666. I remember it because it's so bizarre, but saying that, you know, most people aren't aware of the fact that there's this interesting dialogue online where people are trying to argue, well, it's this diagnosis or this diagnosis, and therefore this is how the person should behave. But the reality is you can have multiple diagnoses.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I could diagnose her with three personality disorders and delusional disorder and make it all be accurate. So I think people sometimes misunderstand that you can be a narcissist and a sociopath and a history of personality disorder. You can be all of these things if they apply. If the criteria fit, then
there's not an either or.
It's permissible to, and I do it all the time. You know, when I sit in front of felons that have done the most heinous things, it's not uncommon to give them multiple diagnoses.
Sure. Right. So you basically answered my next question too, which I think we probably both get this question a lot, or it comes up quite often. But again, people often like to speculate that there's drug use or potential drug use between Lori and Chad and now Julie Rowe. But again, it's this conversation of mental illness. So you touched on Lori. What about Chad? Like, what do you think that just from, you know, your research and findings, what would you correlate his as?
Well, and again, let me qualify this, you know, because psychologists, technically, because of this thing called the Goldwater Rule, we're not supposed to diagnose. And so I always say that it's speculative. I'm not diagnosing. I'm just offering opinions that are speculative, just like anyone in the public would do. And so qualifying that, I would say that, there's clearly some narcissistic features. I don't know if I would diagnose him with narcissistic personality disorder, but
right.
I think there's, you know, it's fair to say that there's enough grandiosity to say, you know, there's so much grand. If you think you're a deity or a prophet,
mm-hmm.
that's a lot of grandiosity. So
absolutely. Right.
That's one of the biggest components of narcissistic personality disorder. So I think there's definitely some narcissistic features with Chad.
In right. our next podcast episode, so it should be episode 12. I'm in the middle of editing it. Someone close to the case wanted to know if Chad had a mental illness or if he was evil. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously a really abstract question. I mean, evil in itself right. is abstract. But thanks to my husband, he is going to try to his best ability to answer this question. So and that is going
yeah.
to be, and we're going to ask that about Chad in the next episode.
Perfect.
Was he evil or did he have a mental illness? That is a question that was asked to us by someone who really wanted to know, and we wanted for this person to try to answer it.
Awesome.
Right. And so, I mean, evil, for a psychologist, evil is a really loaded term.
Sure.
In some way, it's more of a theological term and it's less a psychological term. So I have to kind of
right.
qualify what that means to a psychologist. I think to me, that means just taking sadistic pleasure in harming other human beings.
Yeah.
If you do something just for the pure pleasure of hurting other people, that's about as close as it gets to evil.
Yep.
For me. Mm-hmm. So we asked that question. You know, one of the things that in Chad's autobiography that we talk about is the fact that he took a lot of satisfaction in pulling the wings off of bees when he was in junior high school.
Yeah.
He was walking home from school one day and he saw a bee on the sidewalk and he decided to stomp on it and kill it. And then he saw some more bees and he started pulling the wings off the bees and he said he was deriving satisfaction from that. Wow. And then he heard a voice telling him to stop that, so he stopped it. Mm-hmm. But you know, it raises the question about what kind, you know, is that an evil act? Is he just,
is he enjoying her?
Is he enjoying,
curious, right?
Is he deriving pleasure from killing bees? And, you know, does it take this the supposed outside voice, which we, you know, as a psychologist, I'd say that's his conscience, obviously. The fact that he identifies his voice as coming from outside of himself is a problem. It's scary.
Quite concerning.
Right. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
Right. It would imply that he needs external sources to keep his behaviors in check.
He did say sure. in his biography about killing the bees. He claimed he killed 150. I want to know that we had a beekeeper reach out.
120.
Thank you. We had a beekeeper reach out who said that he didn't believe that he was capable of killing that many. So whatever that means, I mean, I don't think as immune to exaggerating clearly, but he said he killed 120 bees and that he got great satisfaction from it. And satisfaction.
Wow.
So, and I find it really telling to me that in a 200-page
absolutely
article, he chose to share this story. Right,
right.
There's a lot of stories in an autobiography, a 200-page autobiography of me. Like if I one afternoon killed some insects, I don't think that I would find it like newsworthy for the autobiography unless it really, really meant something to me. And clearly this story meant something to Chad about who he was. So, you know, the fact that he chose to share it is interesting.
Tylee, we strongly believe that Tylee pushed back a little bit on their belief, on Chad's beliefs, and that she was questioning Chad to some degree. And then we know that Chad had the bodies in his backyard and Tylee's body was completely disfigured. And we believe that Chad had something to do with that or had a large role in disfiguring Tylee. So the question there is, it's the same thing with the bees, right? The question there is, did he derive pleasure from disfiguring Tylee's body, right? And if he did, is that evil? Right. Is that a mental health issue, or does it go beyond that?
Right.
And so I think I do my best in this episode not to answer the question. I want the listeners to obviously make that decision.
Draw their own conclusions, sure.
But I think it's a reasonable question to ask given some of those variables.
And it immediately made me think of Dahmer, actually, and his relation to the animal torture and what he did and then what he did to his victims. So again, I don't think you're too far off from that. And I didn't even put the two and two together with the bees and then Tylee. I mean, that's, wow.
Dahmer was killing more domestic pets, obviously, but Dahmer, you know,
this is true too. Right.
More on the wild side, but still, yeah, it's a creature.
It's
a creature that is suffering because you're killing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Right.
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 He's getting pleasure from that.
Mm-hmm. So one of the last things I do want to touch on, because I know you brought up Diane Downs at one point, and we know that there are murderous mothers out there. So what would you say is the difference between someone like Casey Anthony to Lori, or Lori to Diane?
Or like Andrea Yates, because Andrea Yates would be...
Yeah.
Andrea Yates would like clearly be the mental illness, right?
The research on filicide, we talked about that in the last podcast, seems to have a common element, which is major depression. For younger children, when mothers kill younger children in particular, it's usually depression at the level of possible psychosis. So I think a lot of younger kids that are getting killed by mothers, it's typically some type of postpartum depression.
Right.
But more recent research is showing that especially with kids that are under 10, a little bit older, that there's probably some element of immaturity and anger and depression. So It's interesting that a lot of people describe Lori as being kind of happy-go-lucky, and it's said that she's like just dancing around every day, happier than a clam. But I don't really see it that way. When I see this in the courtroom, it does seem to me like there's a really flat, the way I describe it is that she comes across as being very flat. She's unemotional. She looks depressed to me. Mm-hmm. But I mean, of course, I haven't sat down and tested her and talked to her in person. And I think this whole bubbly persona or this whole happy-go-lucky persona is more of a fiction. I do think that there's probably some underlying depression.
Yeah.
And she's simply incapable of dealing with that or feeling that. If she went to the sadness, she'd probably be in tears for the next 30 years. So she covers that up with this dancing around and pretending like everything's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Her religious fantasies.
Yeah, and her religious beliefs.
Yeah. But I mean, and also, well,
what?
I mean, there's also psychopathic mothers.
The
very true.
Podcast was that the common element is that they're both psychopaths, and and this, by the way, when we talk about psychopaths, it's really complicated in the sense that the person behind the research on psychopathy, his name is Robert Hare. I actually just did an online seminar with him 2 weeks ago. Hare has always argued that psychopathy should be its own diagnosis in the DSM, and the DSM has not accepted that yet. But he sees it as being different than antisocial personality disorder, which is what the diagnosis is now. And so I've heard a lot of mental health people push back a little and say, well, I don't think she's she's not a psychopath because she doesn't meet criteria for antisocial personality disorder.
Right.
I disagree in the sense that I think she does meet at least Hare's criteria for psychopathy. So I think the common element is for psychopaths, they don't have a conscience.
Right.
You know, in the audio we just heard before we came on with you, Lori essentially says, I wanted to murder Joe Ryan, but I didn't because I went to the temple instead. That, in other words, she needs these external restraints to keep her from murdering this guy, right? She needs the church and the whole infrastructure of the church and the beliefs of the church to keep her from killing someone. That is not having a conscience.
Right.
Like, a conscience is internal. It's something that, you know, when I go somewhere, I just don't, if somebody cuts in front of me in the line at Target, I'm not going to go up to them and hit them.
Right.
Because I have the internal, you know, restraints.
Compass.
I have the moral compass to understand that that's wrong and it doesn't make sense and I'm going to harm someone. Right. But Lori's, she doesn't have that internal compass. She doesn't have the conscience to say, when that person cuts in front of her, she may have murderous impulses. She may not do anything, but the reason she's not doing anything is because she's invoking this belief that it's bad because the church says it's bad. Right. That God or some higher power is telling her not to do it rather than she internally seeing it as being wrong.
Right.
And so neither of them have a conscience. Neither of them experience fear. That's part of one of the biggest parts of psychopathy is the inability to see fear in others and the inability to experience fear. So there's no, we would call it social anxiety. There's no fear of harming other people or consequences of harming other people. And there's a lack of social anxiety with psychopaths.
And right.
With Lori. Lori, you know. She just does. I mean, she just seems without conscience.
And April kind of touched on that too, of saying that she started hiding behind this, I can't remember what she called it, but basically relieving her of any type of sin that she had, which is why she no longer wore garments. She was basically untouchable. But you also brought up depression, which I really bitched about in Julie's seminar, because she talked about depression and acting like it's something that you can get rid of with just playing a happy song. Is basically what she said.
Did she say that?
Yeah.
She said that. Yes. Yeah.
So just to.
I didn't tell him that. Yes. But...
Just the naivete of that is mind boggling.
Yes. But
as somebody who's been around a lot of depressed people and someone who's experienced some depression myself, like that's crazy. That's so misguided.
Exactly.
But consistent with how these folks operate, I think.
Yep. And that's merely what it was. And which is why, you know, I said that their teachings and their beliefs of how you rid these things, it's very problematic. And that's the problem here with followers. It's the followers that I'm scared for now, because if they're taking this as truth, you're not going to rid depression with just putting on a happy song. So that's where I was really upset hearing that. So when you're touched on depression, that's where my head immediately went, oh, but she could put on a happy song. That's all it takes.
Or she can dance around her jail cell with a happy song in her mind, right? Like she can create this illusion that she's not depressed. But She looks depressed. I'll say that. I mean, I don't.
She really does.
I've never sat in front of her, so I can't diagnose it, but.
Seriously, are you guys reading my questions? So my last question, I'm going to ask each of you to answer this. If you could sit down with either Lori or Chad, who would you choose? And what would be your number one question to ask them?
I would choose Chad. Because I believe he's the responsible party for, he's the one who set this chain of events in motion.
Sure.
So, but again, I think that it's a tough question because I think I would get more out of Lori. I think Lori,
really?
Lori would be more amenable to talking openly. I think Chad would absolutely shut down any question that was difficult or emotional or damning in any way. So right. It's possible that if I was in a jail cell with Chad for 10 hours, you know, I might get through a few defenses and, you know, there might be information I could get eventually, but he just seems so numb.
Yeah.
I think it would be really, really difficult to get anything out of him. I think my question to Chad would be,
sorry, hard question.
I'm trying to think of how I would phrase this. So, because it has to be an open-ended question, otherwise it's worthless.
Exactly.
Chad, just start from the top and tell me everything you believe about this, about the New Jerusalem, and how you got to where you're sitting today.
I like it. Yeah, that is good.
I would choose Chad too.
Mm.
I would ask, I think you're trying to get to through the psychological motives, and I can tell more of the journalist. I don't even care if he's lying to me. I think I would say to him, what happened? I think I'm really curious what he's telling people. I think I'm really curious what he told Tammy before she died. I think I'm really curious what he's now telling his kids. So I don't even care if he's lying to me. I just want to hear the story he's telling, right? Whatever it is. Like, so I think I would just say, tell me what happened and see how he comes to the fact that there are two children in his yard, or if he even admits to it, if he says they're animal remains. I just want to hear how he's still possibly manipulating some people in his life, because from all accounts, there are still people that he is telling different stories to, and I want to know what those are. So,
yeah.
I would just say, take it from the top and tell me. Not try to correct him, not try to make sure he's honest, because he's not going to be. I just want to hear what's coming out of his mouth.
Wow. So. I like it. I wasn't expecting the Chad answers from both of you.
I think my second question to Chad would be, tell me what your favorite meal is in jail.
Meatloaf Thursdays.
We all know jail food is really bad. So.
Well, he's losing some pounds, so I would say.
It's
Tater Tot Tuesdays, yeah. Every jail I go into, I hear about the food, so I want to know how the food
is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about,
they always talk French about the,
they always talk about the food because they can't talk about the weather, right? So that's like the most popular, that's the most popular. This topic of discussion.
Oh, I love it. So please let our listeners know what's next for you guys, because like I said, you are doing such a fabulous job of going through this process. I really hope, listeners, you hit that subscribe button, because what these two go into is something that I can't touch on quite yet. But yeah, so what's next for you guys?
Well, that's a good question. We have that conversation every day too.
Yeah.
The questions surrounding the pandemic and quarantining more at home. But
right.
What we hope for, we could definitely answer.
Yeah, so I think we're gonna finish, not completely, but we'll finish our psychological take on this particular, on the Daybell Vallow case, probably in a month. Cool. And concluding with the episode I just talked about, where I talk about Macbeth.
Yeah.
Which is also going to be a really personal episode, by the way. So,
gotcha.
You can have a lot of personal revelations on my part, but disclosures.
Yeah.
I don't want to use the term revelation when we're talking about Chad Daybell.
You didn't murder anyone.
Yeah, there's no.
Well, let's refrain from that one.
He hasn't buried any dead bodies, so that's not what he's talking about here.
Yeah.
But we hope to continue and start another season. And a couple of the things we're talking about are, Lauren covered a case of animal cruelty mm-hmm. when she was a reporter in Boise. That's still a cold case.
It's unsolved. Mm-hmm. Also Idaho.
Yeah.
A pony was tortured. And one thing John and I have talked about is the fact that while true crime is a very popular genre, there isn't a lot being talked about when it comes to animal cruelty. We don't hear about the cases. And which is interesting, because I think a lot of true crime listeners are passionate about protecting animals. And so I think we want to keep hidden crime going. We want to start on some new crimes. Assessing them. And so our first one we're talking about doing is this story. I'll say it's about Patches. Patches the pony, and assess what type of person would do this, and in hopes to maybe bring justice to this pony. Yeah. All the web sleuths help us.
If somebody's willing to torture and mutilate a horse, mm-hmm. I guarantee you they're capable of a lot more than that. So
exactly.
It's really interesting to us that this case has not been solved. And as far as we can tell, not many people in true crime deal with animal cruelty or the psychology of animal cruelty. So I think we want to our goal is to break some new ground a little bit if we can here and there. So I think we'd like to explore that a little bit. It won't be a full season. It might be 3 or 4 episodes.
Sure.
But we'll start with that. And then
we've talked about doing some crimes that people haven't heard of before, and some crimes that are quite well known. We talked about mm-hmm. the possibility of getting John in to do some testing with some well-known criminals that are behind bars for the rest of their lives.
Wow.
Questions about. So we have already been kind with each other. How can we
we're reaching out to some defense attorneys for me to get in to do some, you know, one of the things about the high profile cases in the past that you've talked about is there's been very little formal assessment done with these people. Dahmer had some of that done, but I think it would be amazingly interesting to get in with some of these folks. They're in the news every day. We all know who these people are. And to do some in-depth testing and in-depth interviews and to see what they're really thinking and, you know, what are their real motivations. And so we're reaching out to some contacts, and we're trying to
great
to really, really dig deep with some of these high profile cases that have been solved, but have left a lot of questions unanswered.
Right.
That's great.
And I think also, as we conclude this season, it's called Beyond the Veil, you know, Chad and Lori, Daybell, as we conclude it, we still will follow the case. It's clearly ending anytime soon. So we won't put it aside and then say and be done. We will continue to follow it and give updates and continue to work with you, Celine, because we think exactly
likewise.
Great partnership. We're doing two very different important things, and we want to genuinely, John and I want to be able to help in any way I can. Just like we started out with so many questions on this case, I was able to go to John and ask him the questions because he happens to live with me. And I think that I'm so glad that he's finally been bringing his knowledge to the public.
Amazing. Yeah. You guys are definitely on to some groundbreaking stuff. And I just want to say, as a victim advocate, it's admirable. But again, you guys are onto something. Because I mean, obviously, Tiger King was kind of, you know, this really big pivotal moment of this conversation of animal cruelty, along with, you know, the true crime elements, but also Don't F with Cats was another one that again, that really struck the true crime community in terms of animal cruelty. So I think that's actually, again, really admirable. I know I couldn't do it. As an animal lover, that's very difficult to unpack. I cannot wait, because like I said, this is just such a new wave of true crime and how to do things, but you're having the proper conversations, you're looking at things from different angles, and I love that. And that's the part that I love talking to people like you guys, because at the end of the day, we just want to see justice. It's not, you know, as I told Trisha, it's not this competition thing. We all want the same thing at the end of the day. And I absolutely think we should.
In cases, we should never be a competition, right? We should all help each
absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So maybe there'll be some, you know, maybe there'll be some impetus for change here too, if we're lucky.
Wow. That actually really excites me. I'm glad to hear it. And you guys are on the right path. So with that, where can our listeners find your podcast and follow you on socials?
Yeah. So our website is hiddentruecrime.podbean.com. So we put all of our podcasts on Podbean, but it's on Apple, it's on Spotify, it's on Google, it's on Stitcher, it's on most every platform. You can commonly
it's
find
on it's now on Amazon Alexa and
perfect. All right, well, John and Lauren, this was such a pleasure. Like I said, our conversation will not end just here. Let's definitely reconnect, especially during trial time. I think that will be a really good conversation then. So
we've only started talking about maybe going when it happens, but
deal.
We'll see you there. I don't know. It'll be hard. We'll have work, but
we may have to head to Idaho for the animal cruelty case anyway to do some investigation. Yeah. So
yeah,
sure.
Idaho. Yeah.
Well, if you find your way through Salt Lake City, give me a holler, and I'd love to meet you guys and chat. COVID. Amazing. All right. Well, thank you guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Celine.